This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us. We're here and ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel. In the studio here, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
A spate of deadly attacks in the West Bank has Israel grieving and on edge. To learn who's behind it, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, these attacks have been picking up, especially over the past week. There were two specific attacks that took place that were deadly attacks that took place earlier on the week and then on Thursday morning. And this is where a Palestinian terrorist just driving down the highway, the main highway that goes north-south in the West Bank and stopping at a bus stop the first time earlier on the week from his car, firing on people that were waiting at the bus stop and then driving off. And then this latest one that took place on Thursday morning was a similar event, except the terrorist got out of his car, shot as many people as he could, and then took off in his vehicle. And in the fatalities on Thursday, there were two IDF soldiers that were killed, a bunch of others wounded in this. And then there was from the earlier attack, a mother who was actually pregnant with a 30-week-old child. She didn't die from the woman, sorry, didn't die from the attack, but the baby a couple of days later ended up dying from this terrorist attack. So there is a lot of grieving that's going on with this. There's also the worry that this is going to be part of a large Hamas offensive to take control of the West Bank away from Fatah, who currently controls the West Bank. Hamas is obviously the far more dangerous terrorist group, or Palestinian faction that's also a terrorist group. And so you do have security coordination between Israel and Fatah to try and prevent this from happening. And yet, here we have the success of one cell. Both of these members look like they came from this one cell, with one of the shooters that is still on the run right now.
So for Hamas to be waging these kinds of attacks in the West Bank, it really does have larger implications as far as this rivalry between these different Palestinian factions, a bit of a power struggle taking place here. And this could indicate Hamas feels like the moment is ripe for it to maybe make a move.
Certainly, there is a couple of ways of looking at this. I attended a press briefing on Thursday with Israeli analyst, a longtime analyst of the situation. He kind of thinks that Iran has mobilized Hamas to act right now in the West Bank to try and show that it is continuing its resistance against Israel, because there looks like there might be a lull in the Gaza Strip area where Hamas dominates. Because right now it's accepting, I guess, $15 million cash each month for quiet it's getting from Qatar via Israel. So he says that, well, maybe they're just trying to still show that, hey, we're still fighting for the Palestinian resistance. But we look at this in an entirely different way, just because we have expected Hamas to really dominate, eventually come into power in the West Bank, control the Palestinian Palestinian populace inside the West Bank. And so, I mean, it does look like they are making a push for this. Right now, the situation in the West Bank is extremely destable, not just in terms of terrorist activity, but in terms of the Palestinian population being extremely upset with the Fatah government. There's been massive protests, hundreds of thousands of people coming to the street to really protest simple things, some social issues against the Fatah-led government. And so the people right now are very grieved by the way that they've been led by Fatah. And so it's kind of like a situation where if the Palestinian population inside the West Bank did want to get rid of Fatah, in favor of Hamas, it looks like, well, Iran is just very good at working in a situation like that to come out on top. And so while as I talked to this Israeli analyst who does believe Iran's behind this, he can't see Hamas ever gaining control over the West Bank just because Israel's security forces is a dead set against that. And Palestinians and Israelis, the Fatah, are just working together to try and stop this from happening. However, it seems to me when you do combine the social upset that we have right now with Fatah, the fact that Mahmoud Abbas has ill health and he has no successor, and that there is going to be a power struggle amongst Fatah once he dies, in could be any time. The conditions seem ripe that even though Israel might want it, you could have Hamas dominating and controlling the West Bank.
Well, it is interesting to view this as, say, the man that you spoke with is in terms of the next front in really a three-front offensive by Iran against Israel. If you're looking at the way that they've stepped up their activity from the Gaza Strip, maybe until very recently, together with what we've seen and been talking about happening in southern Lebanon and the tunnels into northern Israel, if you view this, I mean, we really have seen this for quite some time. The fact that Iran has multiple fronts that it's able to mobilize, and it does seem like to see it in that light definitely puts it in appropriate prophetic context.
Yeah, and it should be. And this man I spoke with, I mean, he definitely did see it in that light. You have the three-prong attack with Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Hezbollah in the north, and then in the West Bank with Hamas cells there. And even the leader, remember last month we reported on this, of the Shin Bet said that they arrested 219 Hamas cells in the West Bank in the past year. And, you know, Netanyahu said if not for Israel, Hamas would be in control in 2 minutes in the West Bank. And so the Hamas threat is there. And these are all, again, Iranian proxies. Iran has declared its goal for the West Bank, to take over Jerusalem, to destroy the Jewish state. This security analyst that spoke about how Iran is directing all of this now through Qassem Soleimani. We've talked about him, the IRGC Quds Force leader, and this Hamas and Hezbollah, they're all just pawns. Or let's just not say pawns, let's just say proxies of Iran, and they're directed from Iran. And what's really interesting also about this is our editor-in-chief back in 2006, he wrote an important article. It's entitled "Iran Conquered Lebanon, Now What?" And he looked at Iran's conquest of Lebanon inside the parliamentary elections and what Iran was doing through on the Gaza Strip with Hamas. And then he said the next step's the West Bank. And right now, we've just seen Hamas be dominated by Iran in the Gaza Strip. Now we see these terror tunnels from Lebanon, and it's like the progressive next step, as he brought out, is the West Bank. And now we have that. Now we have Iran opening up a West Bank front against Israel. And so this is something prophetically we expect to take place, just because we know that the Bible talks about how Iran is going to push at Jerusalem from the east, is going to take over half of Jerusalem, lead a revolt to take over half of Jerusalem in a violent way. And the Palestinian faction Fatah doesn't look like they would be willing to do that at all. But Hamas, as directed by Iran, certainly would want that and push for that.
Well, you can certainly get all of the prophetic context you need about that from Gerald Fleury's booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy. And also keep your eyes on thetrumpet.com for an article that Brent has written called Iran Pushes Hamas to Ignite the West Bank. That'll be going up on thetrumpet.com very soon. We appreciate that very much, Brent. As these attacks were taking place in Israel, there was also another deadly terrorist attack in France on Tuesday. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, an Islamist gunman went into the heart of France's oldest Christmas market, where they've got they've been having Christmas markets there since 1570. He had a I think an automatic handgun and a knife, and he began opening fire on members just people of the pub, members of the public. Eyewitnesses said he began his spree by shouting "Allahu Akbar," and began killing people. As of now, I think there are three people that are dead. A further person is brain dead, or I guess in a coma, and they're not sure. They don't think he's going to live. There's another five in critical condition. So, the potential for this death toll to rise significantly, and a lot of people very badly hurt after this. And then there were more even after that, wounded, but in a less critical condition. The gunman then escaped. He took a taxi driver hostage, got away. And the police have, around 1,000 people have been looking for him across both sides of the French and the German border, because Strasbourg is on the border between France and Germany. And then they finally found him last night, Thursday evening, and he was killed in a shootout with police right around the same area where the attack took place.
And now an interesting aspect of this story is that this took place in a secure area of this market after France has already enacted significant measures to try to prevent these types of attacks from taking place. What are the implications of that?
Yeah, this is something that is going, so right now in France, obviously the big news that before this attack was all of these yellow vest protests, these hundreds of thousands across the country that they were turning out, protesting against the government, calling for a new constitution or even a revolution, regime change, very unhappy with the status quo. And now you have this attack where France has, over the past couple of years, passed a whole series of new measures that is meant to keep the nation safe, has stepped up security all across these Christmas markets. This attack takes place within the secure area of a Christmas market, like you say. And I mean, really, it's a big message to the public saying two things. Firstly, these attacks are really hard to stop. What we've done so far is not particularly effective. I mean, we've all been through those bag search things. I think there was one time I accidentally walked in a bag search thing with a water pistol in my bag. Luckily for me, it wasn't found. I mean, they miss. It's very hard to be accurate when you're doing these bag searches and checkpoints, unless you're going to go Israel style and have airport style scanners checking the area. It is genuinely very hard to keep these secure areas even safe. So you've got that aspect, and then it's also just going to add to this anger that's already there against the government. You didn't keep us safe. This guy has been in and out of prisons in France and Germany. He's well known to the authorities. He was on the list of criminals that have probably been radicalized in jail and are in danger of committing a terrorist attack. With all of that there, they still couldn't stop him. So it shows how hard these attacks are to stop, but also that the government's actions so far have not been effective in stopping them at all.
So viewing this in light of just the general unrest and the dissatisfaction among the French populace against the government, you just see this really fomenting that unrest that's already in place.
Exactly. And what we see going on with these attacks in France, it really ties into two of our biggest prophecies that we're watching for Europe. On the one hand, there are those Bible prophecies talking about this change in leadership that's coming to Europe. And not just a change in leadership, not just a new leader being elected, but a change to a much more authoritarian, much less liberal, say, human rights, freedom except valuing government, to something that's much more restrictive and autocratic. The Bible talks about kings ruling in Europe. 10 kings, for example, in Revelation 17, and in the latest issue of The Trumpet, trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote, this soon coming ruler could literally be called a king. Even if he's not, the Bible gives him that title. When the Bible talks about a king, in most cases, it is not referring to a democratic government. Even if this man doesn't have the title king, he will lead like an absolute monarch, like an authoritarian king right out of the Middle Ages. And so when you see people in France becoming angry, not just at Emmanuel Macron, but certainly at him, not just at his party, not just at his policies, but with the constitution, with the system of government, complaining it doesn't matter who we vote for, we always get the same kind of person, they always ignore us, and you see this terrorist attack just accentuating that anger. Well, that's leading to this new kind of system of government that we've been talking about for so long. At the same time, the Bible also talks about this conflict coming between the king of the north and the king of the south. Daniel chapter 11 prophesies this clash between these two. And we've taught, again, since we've had articles going all the way back to the very earliest editions of the trumpet in the early 90s, talking about how Europe, led by Germany, is this king of the north, but certainly including France, like Mr. Flurry's talked about so much recently, and that the king of the south is radical Islam, led by Iran, and that there's going to be this clash, this confrontation between radical Islam and Europe, and that this clash will be instigated by radical Islam pushing at the king of the north, like it says in Daniel chapter 11, around verse 40, provoking Europe. And that's exactly what we see ongoing in Europe. So you can really see how attacks like this fill and fuel both of these major Bible prophecies.
Yeah, that really is an excellent analysis. Richard also has an article up on the trumpet.com, Islamist Gunman Revives Terror in France. And it is something that we have gone back to with terrorist attacks that have occurred in Europe over recent years. This is setting us up for this confrontation between these two great powers that are specifically prophesied in the Bible to clash. So we definitely have a lot to watch for there. Definitely follow those prophecies and keep your eye on thetrumpet.com as that story unfolds. We appreciate that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. An ominous flight mission took place over the Caribbean Sea this past week that should ring some alarm bells in America. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, there were two Russian nuclear-capable bombers that flew a patrol over the Caribbean Sea on Wednesday, and that was after they had taken off from a base in Venezuela. These Russian aircraft had arrived in Venezuela on Monday, and the bombers were two 160 Blackjacks. That's Russia's premier supersonic strategic bomber. And when they touched down in Venezuela, they were accompanied by there was a heavy lift cargo plane and also a passenger plane. And then a couple of days later, they made this patrol over the Caribbean Sea, which lasted for about 10 hours. And the Russians were also accompanied for parts of this patrol by some aircraft from the Venezuelan Air Force. But the two 160 Blackjack bombers are very advanced. It's the most sophisticated bomber Russia has. And each one is capable of carrying a dozen conventional or nuclear-tipped cruise missiles with a range of 3,400 miles. So even if these bombers had stayed put in Venezuela, that would have placed some American cities within those missiles' range. But since they were flying over the Caribbean Sea, that means that a great deal more of the United States would have been within range of them, at least during these flights. So this, you know, it comes at a time during tensions, tensions that are just rising quickly between Russia and the United States. And it looks like just a really defiant and brazen display of Russian aggression right there in the U.S.'s backyard.
And Russia didn't take any steps to try to hide this. They were very open about it. You talk about it being brazen and aggressive, and that definitely does seem to be the case. The strategic implications of having nuclear-armed Russian bombers that close to the United States is quite alarming.
It really is. And this isn't the first time that Russia has sent its Blackjacks to Venezuela. The first time happened in late 2008. That was apparently in response to criticism over Russia's invasion earlier that year of Georgia. And then they sent them there again in 2013, shortly after Venezuelan dictator Hugo Chavez had died and the new president, Nicolas Maduro, had come into power. And that time was basically a kind of a Russian show of solidarity with its Venezuelan allies.
ally, having gone through the leadership transition there. And this time it really seems to be the same basic message. Venezuela and Russia are signaling support for each other and signaling that the U.S. needs to stay out of their affairs, both in Venezuela and in Russia. There are reports that U.S. President Donald Trump has spoken about possibly trying to wage some sort of military action to remove Maduro from power. Those are unconfirmed at this point, but some in his staff have even talked about a military coup to remove him. And of course, U.S.-Russia relations are also at a post-Cold War low right now, largely because of Russia's ongoing aggression against Ukraine, including that incident that we spoke about last month when Russia opened fire on some Ukrainian ships and ended up detaining three of those along with many soldiers. And the U.S. pledged full support to Ukraine after that and even began to increase its weapon shipments to Ukraine. And also the U.S. has been increasing its flight patrols in the Baltic Sea area and the Black Sea area. So that's right in the Russian periphery. And Russia right now seems to really be saying, well, if you want to meddle in our affairs and prop up our enemy and interfere right in our periphery, then we'll meddle in yours here in Venezuela and even in the Caribbean Sea.
Yeah, it's hard not to view this in the context of those events that you're talking about and those steps that Russia has taken to try to curb Russia's aggression. What was the United States' response to this latest flyover?
Well, the U.S. did admonish the Russians for sending this contingent of aircraft to Venezuela and for the flyover as well. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo really tried to reach out to the people of Venezuela and to Russia and just to try to sort of show them that their leadership is not looking after their best interests. He said, Russia's government has sent bombers halfway around the world to Venezuela. The Russian and Venezuelan people should see this for what it is, two corrupt governments squandering public funds and squelching liberty and freedom while their people suffer. And then the White House press secretary also announced yesterday that Russia has said that they're flying those Blackjacks back home sometime today. So it was a brief visit, but it really does show that Russia just remains determined to show the world that it's capable of military operations around the world and that it is able, at least to some degree, to come to the aid of its allies around the globe.
So looking at this prophetically, South America is just such an interesting continent because it's we talk about that so much in relation to the ties that it has with outside powers. China's obviously been very active in there. Here we see Russia. We focus especially on Europe's involvement on that continent. How are you viewing this, say, in context of Bible prophecy?
Well, you're exactly right that there are a few different angles there that you could look at this from in the context of Bible prophecy. I tend to view it most significantly for the one that prophecy says will happen first, kind of in the chronological order there, which would be the Mart of Nations prophecy that's in Isaiah 22 and 23. And it talks about cooperation between the European-led end-time bloc and the Russia-China-led end-time bloc. And they cooperate in a way that blocks the United States out of world trade. It even ends up laying siege around the United States. And once we start to see Russia and China and Europe as well gaining deeper influence in Latin America, it's easy to see how, you know, geographically that positions these nations to really create the conditions for that kind of siege. So Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written quite a lot about that Mart of Nations prophecy, and he's even called attention to Latin America and the geographic location there that makes this quite a prime location for the Europeans and the Asians to begin to try to deepen their influence. In his booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, he's written quite a lot about that and also about Deuteronomy 28, verse 52, that gives more details about this besiegement of America. So we'll be sure to have a link to that book in our show notes for anyone who would like to better understand just why this is really alarming to see the U.S.'s backyard being, you know, just seeing the influence of Russia deepen so much there.
All right. Well, thanks very much for that, Jeremiah. A movement in the United States to abolish borders, to abolish ICE, is growing. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there was a protest this week at the University of Illinois. The protest was conducted by the Gender and Women's Studies Department, saying just what you mentioned. They said you want to abolish the police, abolish ICE, that's the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Department, abolish national borders, and abolish the judicial system. So some really radical calls, and in all honesty, this particular protest is pretty minor, but it does reveal a bigger spirit of what's happening in America. This abolish the police, I mean, Black Lives Matter has made many of those similar calls to what they were calling for at this protest. Abolish ICE, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other people in Congress have made that call.
Right.
Abolish the judicial system. And after the Brett Kavanaugh nominations, even Vox magazine, which is a pretty big name left-wing magazine, has published an editorial floating the idea that we just need to get rid of the Supreme Court and not have one anymore. And so this is it is just really an attack on America, but specifically attack on law, where you've got no judicial system, no borders, no border enforcement, because that would be redundant, and no police department as you know it now. It's crazy, but it is just this spirit. We have a book we'll put in the show notes, America Under Attack, by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, that does actually show like Bible prophecies about the devil waging assault against America here in this end time to just tear down law. There's another article Mr. Fleury wrote sometime back entitled Police Under Attack, where he makes the statement that they are tearing down the police, the nation's last line of defense. They have already torn it down to a great extent. You know what comes after that. As I wrote last month, our cities will be burned with fire. And then he cites a prophecy in Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 7. And now that movement was to tear down the police was much stronger under the Obama administration. There's been a temporary reprieve in America as President Trump shorn up some of those law enforcement agencies. But the spirit's still there. The America Under Attack, the satanic attack on America is still there, and the protest movements that want this lawlessness and anarchy in the United States are still there. They're not going away, and they will make resurgence before the end, and God removes his protection from the nation. So that just really is a important book, America Under Attack, to show what's happening in the United States.
Just out of curiosity, these reformers and radicals who are calling for the abolition of the police and the judiciary, what would they propose to replace it?
Yeah, well, a lot of this, they're like anarchist movements, or where you're looking at more like community policing. I'm actually not sure the details of what they want for the judiciary, but I know for the police in particular, Black Lives Matter has made the same call that communities just need to police themselves. We don't want any other power coming in and policing us. And so it does get down to a very much like the quote from the book of Judges, where there's no king in Israel and every man does what's right in his own eyes. Every community polices themselves according to their own standards.
Well, we were just talking last week about the rise in vigilantism in South America and in South Africa.
Right, both those. And this is kind of in line with that same trend that is, like I said, if you go to the Black Lives Matter website, they've got a section on there on black villages where they talk about each little village needs to do its own policing standards. And so, you know, one city will be different from another city. It's different from, I mean, the founding fathers of America had a type of federalism where each the states could set their own standards and counties could set their own standards, but that's a little different than what they're talking about here. That's still within a state constitutional structure or a city constitutional structure. It's not just popular vote community policing.
Frankly, I'm happy to live under the rule of police departments as they are currently constituted. The idea of having each individual community determine its own standards and decide its own enforcement protocols, that doesn't sound quite like a country that I would want to live in. But we do appreciate that. We do have, I just draw your attention to those articles, that article that Gerald Fleury wrote. This was actually in our August 2015 print edition, Police Under Attack by Gerald Fleury. And this is in the wake of several attacks on police officers and just how dangerous it is when the authority of the police are undermined. And then also looking at the bigger picture, America Under Attack, that booklet that he wrote some years ago, back in 2013, just showing the spiritual dimension to what is happening here and how law is being undermined within the United States of America. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We'll take a short break. Coming up, Theresa May survives a no-confidence vote in Britain, Iran's growing influence in the Iraqi government, joint Air Force drills between Japan and India, and how pornography is affecting behavior in children. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Britain's Prime Minister almost lost her job this week. She managed to survive, but to learn how shaky her position still is and what this means for Brexit, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
I think if I had concrete answers for you in the short term on those, I'd probably be a very wealthy individual. That's the big question that a lot of people are asking. What does that mean for Brexit? Where do we go from here? I mean, things really are looking like a mess and a shambles over here. So, you know, Theresa May out has her big Brexit deal that she spent 2 years negotiating. She presented it, she was about to present it to Parliament. It was scheduled for December 11th. They were meant to have a vote on it. The day before she pulled it, she said, we're not going. It became obvious that it would lose, but it would potentially lose by a huge amount. So she pulled it. She said, I'm going to go back to Europe and I'm going to see if they can give us some better terms. I want something. We'll see if we can get something legally binding so that we're not stuck in this halfway out of the EU where we're subject to all of their rules indefinitely. I'll go back to them and I'll see if we can get a legally binding deadline on that. So that would, she's hoping, would deal with some people's objections and allow her to get it through Parliament. So she did that on Monday. She went off to Europe Tuesday, Wednesday. But amid all of her traveling around Europe, the Conservative Party, enough people were fed up with their leadership that they triggered a vote of confidence in her. So they held the vote of confidence. And she won, but won by a substantially weakened or by a fairly weak amount. She had 200 votes in favor, 117 against. So over a third of the party saying they had no confidence in her as a leader. In the past, that would have been a trigger for some leaders at least to step down. I think it was when Margaret Thatcher won a confidence vote by a similar amount, she ended up stepping down. A few days later, she said she's going to keep going, but she did promise to step down by the time there's another election. She said, basically, I'll get Brexit finished and then we can have a new leader going on into the next election. She went back to Europe to keep going. And Europe has also pretty much said, no, we're not going to change. We're not going to give you what you want to try and get this through Parliament. And so everything's kind of been stuck. debates in Parliament and the vote have been put off now into the new year, where there'll be a break over the, you know, there'll be a break over the winter. And still nobody knows whether this is going to get through Parliament. It looks like it probably won't. And then, well, what happens if that doesn't get through Parliament? There's all kinds of people going back and forth. But you've just got this, you know, Britain going through a major transition, a very important moment in its history. Whether, you know, that's something anyone would agree, whether they're pro-Brexit, anti-Brexit, very important moment. And it just doesn't have the leadership to navigate that moment properly. And that's what I think has become very clear. Well, it's been clear all along, but it's been really illustrated this past week.
And you get the sense that European leaders are deriving a certain amount of pleasure from watching this take place in Britain.
Yeah, I think so. It's an interesting one. I mean, there are some people saying that with all of the unrest that you're having in Europe right now, you know, with all the yellow vest protests in France, etc., that if there ends up being a no-deal Brexit and there ends up being some trade cutoff between Europe and the UK, that it's just going to add to the political chaos in Europe, and they may regret laughing at that. Again, that's one. That's something there's still a lot of contention about. But yeah, there's certainly a fair amount of Schadenfreude. I guess they invented the word.
So we've heard a lot of Stephen Fleury has been talking about this. We've had articles on thetrumpet.com. But you watching this morass taking place in Britain, we have to go back and look at what Herbert W. Armstrong said about this when Britain entered into the relationship with Europe to begin with, that this was going to create serious problems for Britain. And that's absolutely what we have seen happen, even as Britain has tried to extricate itself from that relationship.
Yeah, that's right. And if you go back to this article in 1972, I think it was, and I was going back to that the other day and reading it, and you read that article, and the article's more about Europe than it is about Britain in terms of what he spends most of his time talking about, because that's his point in there, is look, what's building in Europe is the Holy Roman Empire. It's this other resurrection of this power that we've seen rise in Europe repeatedly. And that power is not a pro-Britain power. It's not a power whose goals and whose vision in the world align with Britain in any way. And so, yeah, he said in that, look, you're going to regret shackling yourself to that power. And that's exactly what we've seen. And now when it comes to Britain trying to unshackle itself, well, Europe's got a certain amount of leverage, and because they're that power, they're using it. I think the other prophecy that really comes alive when looking at this, though, as well, is you look at what the Bible talks about and prophesies about the decline of Britain and America, and especially the decline of their leadership.
Mm-hmm.
I think you see that vividly illustrated with what's going on. Hosea 5 and verse 12, for example, God there said, I will be unto Ephraim as a moth. And you know, the image, the picture that he's painting there is, you might have a moth-eaten garment that looks pretty good in the closet, and you take it out of the closet, and you try and put it on, and it all falls to pieces. And that's kind of Britain. You know, it looked pretty good, Britain voting for independence from the EU, and Britain looks on paper, it's got something like the fifth most powerful military in the world, one of the definitely, you know, in the G7 economies. And then you have something like this that requires a bit of gumption, and everything just falls apart like that moth-eaten garment, where the Conservative Party can't agree on anything. Nobody can really agree on anything. Nobody knows what's going to happen, how we're going to move forward. And it's just those prophecies come alive.
That is explained in Gerald Fleury's booklet, Hosea, Reaping the Whirlwind. You can look at that on thetrumpet.com under our literature tab. Gives a lot of explanation of that specific prophecy and others related to the decline in Britain. And that is really true, that you see this kind of leadership crisis within Britain. It is specifically prophesied as well in Isaiah 3. Just a whole lot there that shows the God said exactly that this is the kind of decline that we would see within Britain and also the United States. Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. Back now to the Middle East. A case is going through the U.S. federal courts examining evidence of just how involved Iran was in the Iraq War that killed thousands of troops, American troops. And this has significant ramifications for the government forming in Iraq right now. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So there's two governments in the Middle East that are particularly hamstrung right now, unable to function, that being Iraq, who recently had an election back, I think it was about 8 months ago. It's recent because the government still isn't fully functional yet. And also the government of Lebanon, which also had an election about 8 months ago. But again, no laws have been able to be passed. And the main factor in all of this is the fact that Iran has its own, or has politicians that are loyal to Iran inside these governments that are making it very difficult for the governments to act in a way that is contrary to what Iran wants. And so in Iraq right now, we have the political organization of the popular mobilization units. These were the Shiite militias that were used in the fight against the American forces back in 2003, which is how that court case comes in. And they were also used in the fight against Islamic State. And once Islamic State was removed from power, these Shiites then said, hey, these Shiites militias said, we're not really a fighting force anymore. We'll be part of the Iraqi army, but we want to be a political force. And so during the Iraqi election, they won a lot of seats. And because of the fact that they won a lot of seats, and they're part of the government now because they need to have a coalition to make part of the government, they want key ministries. And the one that they're going after there is the Interior Ministry, which is an extremely powerful ministry in Iraq, which dominates a lot of the decision-making about how the internal workings of the nation will go forward. And then inside Lebanon, we have Hezbollah that basically, although they didn't win a majority of the parliament there, they won the most seats of all the factions. And so there as well, they're still a minority, but they're able to say to the coalition leader, hey, if you want to have a successful government, you've got to give us this, this, and this. And so in both Iraq and Lebanon, we have Iran's voice being extremely strong, and unless they get what they want, those governments aren't going to be able to function.
Now, with respect to Iraq, this is something that the Trumpet, under our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, has been saying would happen, this kind of dominance of Iran over Iraq, since back in the 1990s. And really, it seems what you're describing is just very much a fulfillment of what he said would happen based on Bible prophecy.
Yeah, Bible prophecy talks about Iran leading an end time alliance inside the Middle East that has a pushy foreign policy, and it is made up of other nations as well. And we've talked, as you said, Mr. Gerald Flory did say back in the early 90s that Iraq would likely fall to Iran. And then he restated that when America went in 2003 and invaded Iraq, that at the end of this, Iran is going to dominate Iraq. And we've been calling attention to this for the past decade because it just seems like every story that comes out, there's more and more of Iraq that is falling to Iran. And now that you have Iranian loyalists inside the government maintaining critical positions inside the government, Iran has a foothold on the future of that nation.
Yeah, well, anyone who wants to have more information about this electrifying prophecy needs to go and read Gerald Flory's booklet, The King of the South. It's on thetrumpet.com. It explains exactly why Gerald Flory prophesied that would happen, and it's really one of the most remarkable prophecies that he's given over the time that we've been producing the Trumpet, and we're seeing it come to pass right before our eyes. Thanks very much for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Relations between Japan and India are improving in many ways, and this week the air forces of these two nations conducted drills together. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Japan's Air Self-Defense Force and India's Air Force conducted joint exercises. It was the first time these two powerful nations have conducted joint Air Force drills, the Japanese defense minister said the purpose was to boost understanding between Japan and India and to bolster their relationship of trust. And these drills were branded as exercises in humanitarian assistance and exercises in disaster relief. But many of the specific activities that, they were practicing on their transport aircraft would also have no shortage of wartime applications. So India and Japan are laying the groundwork to be, you know, just to be able to work together in times of crisis, including in wartime.
And this is not the only sign of cooperation increasing between these two countries.
That's right. This is really just the latest in a string of cooperation efforts made by the Japanese and the Indians. In October, they held a maritime exercise. And then just last month, they held their first ever land-based military exercises. And Tokyo and New Delhi have also been working on an agreement that would let the Indian Navy have access to Japan's base in Djibouti, there in East Africa. And then the deal would also let Japan have access to various Indian naval bases and posts. So that'll be a big development when it's finalized. And all of these efforts show that Japan and India are just, you know, really determined to be able to cooperate militarily.
So we've been talking quite a lot in recent episodes about the cooperation increasing between China and Russia, the two largest, most powerful countries within Asia. Here we have two other Asian countries that are aligning, and that really, in some ways, it's part of the same picture, another facet of the same picture that we see happening between Russia and China.
It really is. Yes, the Bible talks in several different places about an end time power block that will come together shortly before Jesus Christ returns. It's called the Kings of the East, and this is an alliance of several Asian nations. And there's one certain prophecy in the book of Ezekiel that shows that both India and Japan will likely be a part of it. This is in Ezekiel 38. And it's right after it shows that Russia will be the lead nation with China in a kind of a secondary position of leadership, as you mentioned there. Right after that, it lists some of the other nations that will also throw their weight behind this. And verse 5 of that chapter lists some ancient names for some of the modern peoples of India, saying that they'll be a part of it. And then verse 6 lists some ancient names for some of the peoples that make up modern Japan, saying that they will also be a part of it. So in light of these scriptures, it's very significant, I think, to see India and Japan drawing closer and closer together and just laying a foundation to be able to use each other's military bases and to be able to cooperate together, because it really is setting the stage for this biblically prophesied Kings of the East alliance to come together.
Well, you can go onto thetrumpet.com and read an article about these specific joint Air Force drills. It's called India, Japan Conduct First Joint Air Force Drills. And then just for the bigger picture, we have our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, that shows the overall picture within the Bible about what we can expect in the time ahead in Asia. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. One last story, a disturbing report out of Kansas City highlighting a growing but little noticed problem, sexual assault of children by other children. To learn about this and why it's happening, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City is one of the five biggest hospitals in the United States for treating sexual trauma or survivors of sexual assault. And shockingly, in the past year, they've treated around 1,000 children who've survived a sexual assault. But according to one of the chief nurses, Heidi Olson, she says, "I think that it's kind of shocking to us all that we're collecting this data is that almost half of our perpetrators are minors." So that's around like 500 children who've been sexually assaulted by another child. And they didn't release specific statistics, but of those 500, the nurses there said they've found some of the perpetrators, interviewed them, and then had them fess up to or be honest about the fact that they're mimicking or copying acts of sexual violence they've seen in pornography, and some as young as five. So you're like, five, six, seven, up to 5 to 14 was, I think, the main range of both assaulters and perpetrators in this study, which is known something that a lot of people who believe in the Bible have known for a long time, that there is a link between pornography and sex crimes. There are others who dispute that, but it is definitely true. Just giving a little bit of a bigger picture overview, the Apostle Paul gives the outline of how a family is supposed to work in Ephesians 5, with a husband representing Jesus Christ, a wife representing a church, a sexual bond binding them together, and then children learning how to relate to the God family from their parents' example. So you start messing with sex or messing with gender roles, and you start creating mental illness, which is what you're seeing here. Is first of all, in all these cases, you've got children who are neglected to the point where they're watching violent pornography online at age 5 to 11. And two, that violent images they're seeing is taking what God designed to be a loving relationship to bind together husband and wife and turning it into an act of violence. Like I said, that does create mental illness and has these children growing up to be rapists and predators because these families allow things like this to happen.
So there is quite a bit of evidence showing that children are seeing pornography at younger and younger ages. And even though you're citing this one report out of Kansas City, this was reported on in an article on LifeSite News. And it cites another study by The Economist that shows draws similar conclusions. The fact that pornography is stirring children, nearly always boys, to sexually assault other children, nearly always girls, and that experts were calling for access to pornography to be restricted as a result. In a lot of ways, this seems like this is something that should be self-evident, that those who argue for open, free access to pornography in general, I don't know how many people are out there arguing that it should be given free access for children, but just the fact that we are so we want to be able to give people access to this, and we don't think that there are going to be negative consequences, but this is definitely something that belies that, and it does. I mean, it really should be common sense that that we would see these kinds of problems result from that.
Right, like you said, you shouldn't need to have a huge study to see that. Like, if you're watching acts of sexual violence, that it's going to have an effect on your mind and make you more likely to commit acts of sexual violence. That's kind of a 2+2 mm-hmm. Correlation, and especially with the rise of the internet, I mean, you can, those who argue for, there's probably few people that argue that 5-year olds should be watching that, but if you put it out there online, there's really no way to stop that from happening unless you've got a parent that's just very vigilant.
This article says, in the United Kingdom, the police apparently received nearly 40,000 reports of children sexually assaulting other children, including 2,600 alleged instances taking place on school grounds. Pornography is grooming boys to be predators and girls to be victims. Really quite alarming. It definitely points to the need for parents to, as you said, to be vigilant, to keep this out of the hands of our children. And really does point to the need for such vigilance to be taking place society-wide, and just what happens when families break down to the point where that we're not protecting our children in that way. Well, we appreciate that. Andrew, I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. Email us your thoughts by sending your emails to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Gino Chi. I'll leave you with the words of Charles Chaput. Evil preaches tolerance until it is dominant, and then it tries to silence good. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.